Good morning and welcome to Sun Sounds of Tucson. My name is Alan Jones and I will be reading the news today from the Arizona Daily Star. Today's date is the 24th of July, 2025. Our headlines for today. Bondi told Trump he was in Epstein files. Trump allowed to remove Democrats on safety commission and Koberger gets life imprisonment. Our first story. Bondi told Trump he was in the Epstein files. Attribution to the Associated Press. Attorney General Pam Bondi is facing Democratic calls to testify before Congress following a newspaper revelation that she told President Donald Trump his name appeared in the files of the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking investigation. The Wall Street Journal reported Wednesday that Bondi told Trump his name was among many high-profile figures mentioned in the files, which the Justice Department this month said it would not be releasing despite a clamor from online sleuths, conspiracy theorists, and members of Trump's base. Trump's personal ties to Epstein are well established and his name is already known to have been included in records related to the wealthy financier who killed himself in jail in 2019 as he awaited trial on sex trafficking charges. Senator Adam Schiff, a California Democrat, responded to the report by calling on Bondi and FBI Director Kash Patel to appear before a Senate Judiciary Committee. We need to bring Bondi and Patel into the Judiciary Committee to testify about this now, Schiff said in a video posted on X. The Justice Department declined to comment on the report, but issued a joint statement from Bondi and Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche saying that investigators had reviewed the records and nothing in the files warranted further investigation or prosecution. As part of our routine briefing, we made the president aware of the findings, the statement said. The mere inclusion of a person's name in Epstein files does not imply wrongdoing, and he was known to have been associated with multiple prominent figures, including Trump. Over the years, thousands of pages of records have been released through lawsuits, Epstein's criminal dockets, public disclosures, and Freedom of Information Act requests. They include a 2016 deposition in which an accuser recounted she spent several hours with Epstein at Trump's Atlantic City casino, but didn't say if she met Trump and did not accuse him of any wrongdoing. Trump has also said he once thought Epstein was a terrific guy, but they later had a falling out. White House spokesman Steve Cheney on Wednesday said the reports were nothing more than a continuation of the fake news stories concocted by the Democrats and the liberal media in other developments on Wednesday. A judge rejected a Trump administration request to unseal transcripts from grand jury investigations of Epstein's years ago in Florida, though a similar request for the work of a different grand jury is pending in New York. A U.S. District Judge, Robin Rosenberg, in West Palm Beach, said the request to release grand jury documents from 2005 and 2007 did not meet any of the extraordinary exceptions under federal law that could make them public. The Justice Department last week asked the judge to release records to quell a storm among supporters of Trump who believe there was a conspiracy to protect Epstein's clients, conceal videos of crimes being committed, and other evidence. The House Committee on Oversight voted on Wednesday to subpoena the Department of Justice for the files. Three Republicans on the panel voted with Democrats for the subpoenas, sending it through an 8-2 vote tally. Republican subcommittee chairman Representative Clay Higgins of Louisiana said that work to draft the subpoena was beginning. The vote came just hours before the House was scheduled to end its July work session and depart Washington for a month-long break. House Speaker Mike Johnson, who adjourned major business in the House ahead of Congress, August recess, to avoid contentious votes on Epstein-related matters, as the Trump administration faces intense public pressure to release more information about the sexual predator. In 2008, Epstein cut a deal with federal prosecutors in Florida that allowed him to escape more severe federal charges and instead plead guilty to state charges of procuring a person under 18 for prostitution and solicitation of prostitution. Todd Blanche, the deputy attorney general that asked judges in Florida and New York to unseal transcripts from grand jury proceedings that resulted in indictments against Epstein and former girlfriend Ghislaine Maxwell, saying, "Transparency to the American public is of the utmost importance to this administration. Federal grand juries hearing evidence in secret and then decide whether there is enough for an indictment." Experts say the transcripts likely would not reveal much because prosecutors typically are trying only to present enough material to get charges and don't introduce the entire investigation. Epstein, a wealthy financier, years later was arrested in 2019 on federal sex trafficking charges, while Maxwell was charged with helping him abuse teenage girls. Epstein was found dead in his cell at a federal jail in New York City about a month after he was arrested. Investigators concluded he killed himself. Maxwell later was convicted at trial and sentenced to 20 years in prison. The case attracted attention because of Epstein and Maxwell's links to famous people, including royals, presidents, and billionaires. It also led to some of the biggest conspiracy theories animating Trump's base. The furor over records has been stoked by the Justice Department. In February, far-right influencers were invited to the White House and provided with binders marked "The Epstein Files, Phase 1, and declassified. The binders contained documents that had largely already been in the public domain. The department on July the 7th acknowledged that Epstein did not have a list of clients. It also said no more files related to this case would be made public. Two-page memo that bore the logos of the FBI and Justice Department, but that was not signed by any individual, said the department determined that no further disclosures would be appropriate or warranted. Our next story. Trump allowed to remove Democrats on safety commission. Attribution to Mark Sherman of the Associated Press. The Supreme Court on Wednesday allowed the Trump administration to remove three Democratic members of Consumer Product Safety Commission who had been fired by President Donald Trump and then reinstated by a federal judge. The justice acted on an emergency appeal from the Justice Department, which argued that the agency is under Trump's control and the president is free to remove commissioners without cause. That's what Trump did in May, provided no reason for removing all three Democratic commissioners on the five-person board, despite a federal law that allows commissioners to be fired only for neglect of duty or malfeasance. The court provided a brief unsigned explanation that the case is similar to earlier ones in which it allowed Trump to fire board members of other independent agencies whom Congress protected from arbitrary dismissals. The three liberal justices dissented. By means of such actions, this court may facilitate the permanent transfer of authority piece by piece by piece from one branch of the government to another, Justice Elena Kagan wrote for herself, as well as Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanya Brown Jackson. The commission helped protect consumers from dangerous products by issuing recalls, suing errant companies, and more. The fired commissioners had been serving seven-year terms after being nominated by President Joe Biden. U.S. District Judge Matthew Maddox in Baltimore ruled in June that the dismissals were unlawful. Maddox sought to distinguish the commission's role from those of other agencies where the Supreme Court had allowed firings to go forward. A month earlier, the High Court's conservative majority declined to reinstate members of the National Labor Relations Board and the Merit Systems Protection Board. Findings that the Constitution appears to give the president the authority to fire the board members without cause. The administration has argued that all the agencies are under Trump's control as the head of the executive branch. Maddox, a Biden nominee, noted that it can be difficult to characterize the Product Safety Commission's functions as purely executive. The fight over the president's power to fire could prompt the court to consider overturning a 90-year-old Supreme Court decision known as Humphrey's Executor. In that case, from 1935, the court unanimously held that presidents cannot fire independent board members without cause. The decision ushered in an era of powerful independent federal agencies charged with regulating labor relations, employment discrimination, the airwaves, and much more. But it has long rankled conservative legal theorists who argue the modern administrative state gets the Constitution all wrong because such agencies should answer to the president. Kagan wrote that the court already has all but overturned Humphrey's executor. Other removals are making their way to the High Court, including the firing of a member of the Federal Trade Commission, the very agency at issue in Humphrey's executor. Last week, a federal judge ordered Rebecca Slaughter reinstated as a commissioner. Slaughter returned to work on Friday. By Tuesday, she had been sidelined again after an appeals court temporarily blocked the judge's order. The Consumer Product Safety Commission was created in 1972. Its five members must maintain a partisan split with no more than three representing the president's party. They serve staggering terms. That structure ensures that each president has the opportunity to influence but not control the commission, attorneys for the fired commissioners wrote in court filings. They argue the recent terminations could jeopardize the commission's independence. Our next story. Koberger gets life. Attribution to Rebecca Boone and Jean Johnson of the Associated Press. One after another, the friends and family of the four University of Idaho students murdered by Brian Koberger vented their emotions in sobs, insults, and curses before a packed courtroom Wednesday as he was sentenced to life in prison. Ben Mogan, the father of Madison Mogan, credited her with helping to keep him alive through his fight with addiction. He called her the only thing I'm proud of. Dylan Mortensen, a roommate of the victims who told police of seeing a strange man with bushy eyebrows and a ski mask in their home that night, called Koberger a hollow vessel, something less than human. She shook with tears as she described how Koberger took the light they carried into each room. Hell will be waiting, Christy Conclaves, the mother of Kay's Conclaves, told the killer. Judge Stephen Hipper ordered Koberger to serve four life sentences without parole for first-degree murder in the deaths of Mogan, Conclaves, Zana, Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin. The defendant was also given a 10-year sentence for burglary and assessed $270,000 in fines and civil penalties. Koberger, 30, pleaded guilty just weeks before his trial was to start in a deal to avoid the death penalty. Prosecutors and defense attorneys agreed on the sentence. When it was his turn to speak in court, Koberger said, I respectfully decline, shedding no light on why he slipped into the rental home in Moscow, Idaho, through a sliding glass door early on November the 13th, 2022, and brutally stabbed four of the students. I share the desire expressed by others to understand the why, Hippler said. But upon reflection, it seems to me that this is just my own opinion, that my continuing focus on why we continue to give Mr. Koberger relevance, we give him agency, and we give him power. The crime horrified the city, which hadn't seen a homicide in about 5 years, and prompted a massive search for the perpetrator. Some students took a rest of their classes online because they felt unsafe. Koberger, a graduate student in criminology at nearby Washington State University, was arrested in Pennsylvania, where his parents lived roughly 6 weeks later. A Q-tip from the garbage at his parents' house and genetic genealogy was used to match Coburg's DNA to material recovered from a knife sheath found at the home, investigators said. They used cell phone data to pinpoint his movements and surveillance camera footage to help locate a white sedan that was seen repeatedly driving past the home on the night of the killings. But investigators told reporters after Wednesday's hearing that exhaustive efforts had failed to find the murder weapon, the clothes Koberger was wearing at the time, or any connection between the killer and the students. This world was a better place with her in it, Scott Laramie Morgan, stepfather, said. Karen and I are ordinary people, but we lived extraordinary lives because we had Maddie. Conclave's father, Steve, taunted Coburg for getting caught despite his education in forensics. You were that careless, that foolish, that stupid, he said. Master's degree, you're a joke. Kernodle's father, Jeff, recalled that his daughter hadn't been feeling well that night, and he thought about driving 7 miles, which is 11.3 kilometers, to the rental home to be with her. He decided against it because he had been drinking. Mortensen and another surviving roommate, Bethany Funk, described crippling panic attacks after the attack. I slept in my parents' room for almost a year and had them double lock every door, set an alarm, and still check everywhere in the room just in case someone was hiding. Aliva Conclave's voice didn't waver as she asked Koberger questions, including what her sister's last words were. She drew applause after belittling Koberger, who remained expressionless. You didn't win, you just exposed yourself as the coward you are, Aliva Conclaves said. We will now move on to the Tucson and region news. Our first story. Illegal hiring raid was an aberration, CEOs say. Attribution to Danielle Gonzalez of the Arizona Republic. A head of Arizona's Restaurant Association is not worried that the federal immigration raid at several Colt Grill Northern Arizona locations signal that ICE has started widespread restaurant raids in the state. The July 15 raid by federal agents involves allegations of illegal hiring practices against the owners of Colt Grills that are far outside the norm in Arizona's restaurant industry, says Steve Chuchuri, president and CEO of Arizona Restaurant Association. The restaurant industry depends on immigrants to do jobs others are often unwilling to do, Chuchuri said. Most restaurants follow state and federal laws to hire legal workers, but sometimes learn through Social Security Administration notices that some workers may be unauthorized, Chuchuri said. We see that time and again, where restaurants unintentionally hire immigrant workers not authorized to work in the U.S. despite following employment verification laws, Chuchuri said. But that is not what we have here in the federal investigation of Colt Grill, Chuchuri said. We have someone that appears to have been very willingly neglected the process, and it falls far outside the lines of what we are as an industry believe should be the proper hiring protocols for restaurants. The Colt Grill investigation appears to be more about bad actors performing badly than ICE carrying out raids against random restaurants. On July the 15th, federal agents with Homeland Security Investigations, which is part of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, raided 4 Colt Grill barbecues and spirit locations in Prescott, Prescott Valley, the village of Oak Creek, Sedona, and Cottonwood in northern Arizona, and 1 Colt Grill location in Foley, Alabama. Federal agents arrested the owners of the restaurants, Robert and Brenda Clouston, both 61, and 2 others, Luis Pedro Rogel Hames, 33, and Iris Romero Molina, 29, on charges of conspiracy to transport illegal aliens, conspiracy to harbor illegal aliens, conspiracy to encourage and induce an alien to unlawfully enter the U.S., and a pattern of practices knowingly employing unauthorized aliens. A federal grand jury indictment accuses the four defendants of taking part in a scheme to pay to have undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. to work in the restaurants, creating a cleaning company to pay the unauthorized workers with funds from the restaurants and leasing houses for some of the unauthorized workers to live in. Rogel Jaimes and Romeo Molina are Mexican nationals who were living in the U.S. without authorization, federal prosecutors said. Several undocumented workers were also arrested on immigration violations, prosecutors said. The undocumented workers were paid below minimum wage and were not compensated for overtime, federal prosecutors said. The Claustons and Rogel Jaimes and Romeo Molina benefited financially from the scheme and did not pay proper employment taxes for the workers, federal prosecutors said. The Claustons and Rogel Jaimes and Romero Molina pleaded not guilty to all charges on Monday, July the 21st, in U.S. District Court of Arizona in Flagstaff, according to court filings. Brenda Clouston was released on her own recognizance, court filings show. A detention hearing for Robert Clouston was set for July the 24th, court filings show. Detention hearings were set for July the 28th for Romero Molina and July the 29th for Rogel Jaimes. Federal prosecutors said the Colt Grill raid kept a three-year investigation, but is part of the Trump administration's aggressive nationwide immigration crackdown. The Colt Grill raid happened a week before federal agents arrested the owner of a West Phoenix taqueria and several food truck following an immigration raid on July the 8th. Vladimir Arguello Andreves, 42, owner of the Taqueria El Taco Loco restaurant at West Indian School Road and North 67th Avenue and food trucks in Phoenix, was arrested on charges of harboring unauthorized immigrants, knowingly employing people unauthorized to work in the U.S., improper entry into the U.S., and being an unauthorized immigrant in possession of a firearm, according to a federal prosecutor. Anguello, his businesses, and his associates were under surveillance for nearly 5 months, from March through July 2025, according to federal court records. The Arizona Restaurant Association president said restaurant owners need not worry if they are complying with state and federal employment and hiring laws. That includes requiring all prospective employees to complete federal I-9 employment eligibility verification forms and keeping those forms on file for possible inspection by the proper authorities. Under the 2008 Legal Arizona Workers Act, employers are also required to use the federal government's E-Verify electronic verification system to check the work eligibility of all new hires. What we've been telling restaurant owners is to make sure that they're going through the I-9 process as well as the E-Verify process and all the proper protocols and hiring procedures, and that they should be fine. The recent restaurant raids in Arizona comes amid growing complaints from agriculture and hospitality industry leaders that the Trump administration's increasingly aggressive immigration raids and arrests are taking away workers that are difficult to replace. In June, President Donald Trump acknowledged the immigration crackdown was hurting farmers and the hospitality and leisure industry and suggested changes were coming, but after facing a backlash from immigration hardliners, the crackdown intensified. Chuchuri said he is hopeful the crackdown will push Congress to take long-awaited action and pass immigration reforms that allow immigrants to work legally rather than illegally. On July the 15th, a bipartisan group of 10 Republicans and 10 Democratic lawmakers in the House introduced legislation that calls for a nationwide mandate of the E-Verify system and other immigration and border security enhancements, along with providing an opportunity for undocumented immigrants to have been in the U.S. for at least 5 years to earn legal status. What we really need to happen is the administration and Congress to work together to bring about some form of immigration policy that makes sense and that can put us on a path forward that not only can benefit the restaurant industry, but all industries that need import labor. Our next story. Star Printing moving to Vegas in October. Attribution to Charles Baller of the Arizona Daily Star. The Arizona Daily Star will be printed in Las Vegas, Nevada, starting in October, due to the closure of a Gannett printing facility in Phoenix that now prints the Star as well as the Arizona Republic. Print editions will have to be trucked from Las Vegas, but the change will not affect delivery times to customers, said Arizona Daily Star executive editor David McCumber. Gannett announced Tuesday that the printing facility in Phoenix will close in October, resulting in layoffs of 117 of its employees there. Printing operations for the Republic, a Gannett newspaper, will also move to Las Vegas in October. The Star will continue to be printed 7 days a week, the final day of Phoenix printing for the Arizona Daily Star, a Lee Enterprise newspaper, will be on October the 5th. We're still going to put out a daily newspaper. We're going to put out the best paper that our deadlines will allow us to put out, just as we do now, McCumber said. We've been out of the immediate breaking news business for a while in print. We're used to not having the late deadlines that having our own presses afforded us. So it's an adjustment, he said. The Star has been printed in Phoenix since its printing presses in Tucson closed in 2019. We value our print customers, and nothing changed as far as our commitment to print. We're going to continue to give our print customers an excellent product, McCumber said. We will still be able to produce the deep enterprise that we do and the features. Having to adjust to new deadlines is nothing new in this business. We've been doing this for years. Readers will still find breaking news, sports, and all of Tucson's news through the Star's website, tucson.com, as well as the newspaper E-Edition, which all print subscribers have access to. We still have the tools of immediately and the ability to break news online. We'll be depending on our E-Edition and the rest of tucson.com to present the latest news, McCumber said. We've got to use each platform to its best purpose, and the best way to get breaking news is online. It has been that way for several years, and that won't change. The Star's news, advertising, finance, and circulation staff are all staying in Tucson. All Gannett employees involved in the printing process in Phoenix will receive several packages once the plant closes, and after operations cease, a small number of employees will be retained to help relocate or decommission equipment and clean the facility, the Arizona Republic reported. The Gannett facility in Phoenix also prints the Ventura County Star, the Ventura County Star, the Victorville Daily Press, and Palm Springs-based Desert Sun. The transition will result in those papers moving print operations to Riverside, California. Our next story. Peterson, axe tax breaks for filmmakers. Attribution to Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services. The Arizona Senate president is trying to undo tax incentives designed to lure Hollywood producers to Arizona, incentives backed by half the senators of his own party. In a new legal brief, President Warren Peterson, a Gilbert Republican, contends the 2022 law that sets aside up to $125 million a year in refundable tax credits runs afoul of the Arizona Constitution. He says the way the law is structured makes those credits effectively a gift of public funds. Peterson is even telling a judge that despite the legislature's broad authority to set tax policy, the court has the power to overrule it when deciding lawmakers have gone too far. He's not the first to make that argument. Peterson's filing is in line with a lawsuit filed earlier this year by the Goldwater Institute asking a judge to overturn the law. but it is unusual because it amounts to the Senate president acting in his official capacity trying to void legislation sponsored by a fellow Republican, in this case David Goen. Goen, a Sierra Vista Republican, convinced half of his GOP Senate colleagues to support the film credit measure and got them, Governor Doug Ducey, to allow it to become law, albeit without his signature. Peterson did not respond to a request for comment on the filing, nor did he or his press aide answer questions of whether the filing, made on his behalf by a private law firm, was done with public money. Proponents said the 2022 law was designed to breathe new life into what was once a more thriving industry in Arizona, dating back at least as far as 1930, when John Ford saw Monument Valley and decided to film stagecoaches here with John Wayne. The studio of Old Tucson, where long the site of various westerns, ranging from The Lone Ranger to Three Amigos, before much of the facility was destroyed in the 1994 fire. More recently, productions that are supposed to portray events in Arizona were being filmed elsewhere. For instance, Only the Brave, the 2017 film about the death of Granite Mountain hotshots from Prescott, was filmed primarily in New Mexico. To provide a financial lure, Arizona lawmakers approved tax credits that apply against what a production company otherwise owes the state. The problem, according to the Goldwater Institute lawsuit filed earlier this year, is that these are refundable credits. Put another way, if the amount of credit exceeds the tax owed, the production company actually gets a check from the state. Challengers claim this violates a provision in the Arizona Constitution that makes it illegal to provide a gift of state funds unless taxpayers get something of equal benefit in return. Proponents of the 22 law contend these are not gifts or grants, arguing that the state will get benefits in the form of sales tax spent by production companies and their employees, as well as income taxes from the workers who are hired. But the lawsuit says Arizona courts have ruled that only direct benefits count, not anticipated future tax collections. The Arizona Commerce Authority also is telling the judge, Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Michael Herod, that it is up to the legislature, not the court, to determine tax policy. Peterson, in his legal filing, in his capacity as Senate President, told the judge to ignore those arguments. It is true, he said, that the legislature can enact any law its discretion may dictate. But even that expensive authority is modulated by the Constitution, structural constraints on the elected branches, Peterson said. If a legislative enactment veers outside of those guardrails, it is the court's core constitutional authority and duty to ensure that the Arizona Constitution is given full force and effect. That is true with the Constitution gift clause, he said, which spells out that the state cannot provide any donation, grant, or subsidy to any individual, association, or corporation. He said, it's one thing to forgive taxes owed, but what's at issue here, he said, is a credit that is independent of a company's actual liability. It is, as a matter of law and common sense, a subsidy within the meaning of the gift clause, Peterson said. He also suggested those who crafted the film credit law and others like it were too cute in how they described them. Because the lexicon of tax credits is more mellifluous than many voters' ears than the terminology of handouts, interest groups and their allies devising new subsidies often are tempted to seek the cloak of the tax code in the hope that opponents of a generous social welfare state will not find out what we are doing, Peterson said. But cosmetic political nomenclature cannot alter the inescapable fiscal and practicality reality that refundable credits represent direct redistributive expenditures of government funds. For example, revenues collected from other citizens to the claimant taxpayer. this isn't the first time the merits, if not the legality, of these tax credits have been questioned. The state enacted a similar program in 2005 and expanded it to 2007. A report said the credits generated 317 full-time jobs in the industry in 2008. Another 413 were created indirectly from spending by filmmakers in the state. All totaled, according to the report, that generated about $2.3 million in additional state and local taxes. But it turned out Arizona gave out more than $8.6 million in credits to get that gain. A similar report for 2007 showed a $1.7 million loss to the state. Lawmakers repealed the program in 2015. Gowan, however, insisted that the new credits are different than the prior program. He said they require those seeking the credits to show, subject to a state audit, that they have spent the money in Arizona. Our next story. Two men accused in theft ring targeting Arizona Walmart stores. Attribution to Erica Verst of the Arizona Daily Star. Two men have been indicted on a combined 70 counts of organized retail theft and property trafficking after a two-year investigation into thefts from Walmart stores across the region. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays announced Wednesday that a state grand jury indicted Alexander Moreno Danzela and Christopher Campos Henriquez in connection with a property trafficking ring targeting Walmart stores throughout the Pima, Maricopa, Pinal counties, Graham, Mojave, and Yavapai counties. The ring allegedly stole more than $140,000 in merchandise from Walmart stores across Arizona, Mays' office said. Investigators were conducted by the Arizona Attorney General's office in conjunction with the Pima County Sheriff's Department, the Oro Valley Police Department, the Arizona Department of Public Safety, and the Sorita Police Department. Our next story. Fire debris gives new life via recycling. Attribution to Dorene Pineda of the Associated Press. Candace Frazee recently walked through the burnt remains of the Bunny Museum, searching for anything that could be salvaged before workers cleared the land. The Eaton Fire in Southern California in January scorched more than 60,000 bunny objects and memorabilia, leaving behind mounds of ash, steel and concrete littered across the landscape. Giant bunny statues that once greeted guests were left just wiry, hollow skeletons. Her home in the back was also gone. Yet amid the debris, valuable materials are redeemed. Metal, concrete, and some trees are recycled and given new life. It's fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic, Frazee, who co-founded the museum with her husband, said of recycling the materials, that's the right thing to do. After the Palisades and Eaton fires scorched entire neighborhoods, the Army Corps of Engineers set up operations to recycle concrete and metal from mostly fire-damaged homes. Metal is compacted and concrete is crushed, then trucked to recycling facilities before re-entering the supply chain for future uses. Some trees and shrubs are processed and sold. A lot of this material can be reused in future construction. That's just good for the environment, said Colonel Sonny Abichal, an Army Corps commander for the Eaton Fire. So there is definitely this notion of, you know, a lot of the stuff that we're able to recover will actually come back and help rebuild Altadena. The agency said these operations sped up recovery efforts, reducing waste going to landfills and helped lower the number of trucks on the road. But there also sparked some worries. Residents raised concerns that the work produces or kicks up particles into the air. The Army Corps maintains it's ensuring operations are safe by monitoring air quality and watering the sites to minimize dust. A large dump truck filled with wiry and garbled steel arrived at an Altadena golf course that was partially burned. The metal pulled from the fire destroyed properties was compacted here before it was trucked to a recycling facility where it can be melted, cast, and resold. A steel beam can become a steel beam again, or be morphed into a car door or roof panel. Across the globe, the steel industry represents an estimated 8% of planet warming emissions and just 1% to 2% in the US, the fourth largest steel producer. According to the American Iron and Steel Institute, a trade association, recycled steel doesn't lose its quality. Annually, about 60 million to 80 million tons of steel scrap are recycled into new products in North America. Every refrigerator that's recycled reduces 215 pounds of carbon dioxide emissions, according to the group's estimates. Steel is infinitely recyclable, said Adina Renee Adler, executive director of the Global Steel Climate Council, an industry group working to reduce carbon emissions. It is, in fact, the most recycled material out of everything that we have. Adler hopes people who lost homes to the fire will feel a glimmer of hope knowing some of these materials will be given new life. That could be for someone else, somewhere else, or to build their own homes anew. The concrete that arrived to these facilities is pulverized into large concrete chunks, piled 10 feet tall into 1.5 and 3 inch pieces, before being trucked to local construction materials companies. In its new form, concrete can be used to elevate grounds to construction sites, for example, or provide a base layer before pavement is applied, or to be used to create concrete again. Making concrete is responsible for roughly 8% of global carbon dioxide emissions and 2% in the US, most of which come from producing and processing its predecessor, cement. That's because coal and other fossil fuels, which emit greenhouse gases when burned, are the main energy sources for making cement. And the actual chemical reaction that occurs when producing it also releases planet-warming emissions, said Ben Skinner, a manager on the cement and concrete team with RMI, a group working to accelerate the clean energy transition. Recycling concrete doesn't substantially lower its carbon footprint, he added. It does, however, have great environmental impacts because it reduces the extraction of new raw materials when it's turned into aggregate, stuff like sand or gravel used to make. While still producing high-quality materials, it also keeps waste from going to landfills. Large trees were knocked into homes and parkways from the same powerful winds that sent fires out of control, and the infernos scorched canopies, trees that fell into the ash, get sent to landfills. Others that are still standing and pose a safety risk are cut down. Some logs are sent to mills to be manufactured into lumber that can be used in the rebuilding process. Others are mulched to become soil amendment. Organic matter added to soil improves its quality, then sold to companies and farmers, said Matthew Long, senior program manager for Environmental Chemical Cooperation and contractor running the operations. Long has done fire recovery work for nearly a decade, including in Hawaii after the Lahaina fires and other California blazes in 2017 and 18. It's really rewarding work, he said. You're interfacing with someone who lost everything daily and helping them to move to the next step of recovery. We will now move on to the nation and world news. Our first story. Negligence could violate the law. Attribution to Molly Quell and Mike Corder of the Associated Press. The United Nations top court said Wednesday in a landmark advisory opinion that countries could be in violation of international law if they fail to take measures to protect the planet from climate change. The nations harmed by its effects could be entitled to reparations. Advocates immediately cheered the International Court of Justice opinion on nations' obligations to tackle climate change and the consequences they might face if they don't. Failure of a state to take appropriate action to protect the climate system may constitute an internationally wrongful act, Court President Yuri Isawara said during the hearing. He called the climate crisis an existential problem of planetary proportions that imperils all forms of life and the very health of our planet. The non-binding opinion, backed unanimously by the court's 15 judges, was hailed as a stunning point in international climate law. Notably, the court said a clean, healthy, and sustainable environment is a human right. That paves the way for other legal actions, including returning to the ICJ to hold each other to account, as well as domestic lawsuits, along with legal instruments like investment agreements. The case was led by the Pacific Island nation of Vanuatu and backed by more than 130 countries. All UN members states include major greenhouse gas emitters like the United States and China are parties to the court. Activists could bring lawsuits against their own countries for failing to comply with the decision, which ran to over 130 pages. Climate activists gathered outside the crowded court with a banner that read, "Courts have spoken. The law is clear. States must act now." After years of lobbying by vulnerable island nations who fear they could disappear under rising sea waters, the UN General Assembly asked the ICJ in 2023 for an advisory opinion, an important basis for international obligations. Its panel was tasked with answering two questions. What are countries obliged to do under the international law to protect the climate and environment from human-caused greenhouse gas emissions? Second, what are the legal consequences for governments when their acts or lack of action have significantly harmed the climate and environment? Our next story. Organizations warn of a surging famine in Gaza. Attribution to the Associated Press. More than 100 charities and human rights groups said Wednesday that Israel's blockade and ongoing military offensive are pushing Palestinians in the Gaza Strip towards starvation. And Israeli strikes killed another 29 people overnight, according to local health officials. Meanwhile, the Trump administration's Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, was scheduled to meet with the senior Israeli officials about ceasefire talks. Experts say Gaza is at risk of famine because of Israel's blockades and the offensive launched in response to Hamas's October 7, 2023 attack. The head of the World Health Organization said Gaza is witnessing a deadly surge in malnutrition and related diseases. Israel claims it allows enough aid into the territory and false delivery efforts by UN agencies, which say they are hindered by Israeli restrictions and the breakdown of security. Hamas says it will only release the remaining 50 hostages it holds, about 20 of them believed to be alive, in exchange for a lasting ceasefire and an Israeli withdrawal. Israel vows to recover all the captives and continue the war until Hamas is defeated or disarmed. Our next story. Authorities investigate Harvard's visa program. Attribution to the Associated Press. In the latest in a series of Trump administration inquiries targeting Harvard University, the State Department said Wednesday it is investigating whether the Ivy League school will remain part of a government program that provides American visas for students and researchers from other countries. Harvard faced mounting sanctions and scrutiny from Washington since rejecting demands from the Federal Anti-Semitism Task Force in April. Harvard filed a lawsuit challenging a $2.6 billion in federal cuts and accused the Republican administration of waging a retaliation campaign. The statement from Secretary of State Marco Rubio did not say why his department was examining Harvard's eligibility to take part in the Exchange Visitor Program, which allows foreign nationals to study or work in the United States through cultural and education exchange programs. It said all sponsors, such as Harvard, are required to fully comply with exchange visitors' regulations, transparency in reporting, and a demonstrated commitment to a fostering the principle of cultural exchange and mutual understanding upon which the program was founded. Our next story. Man indicted in homemade bomb plots. Attribution to the Associated Press. A New York man accused of plotting to set off homemade explosives he stashed at sites across Manhattan was indicted, federal prosecutors said. Michael Gann, 55, built at least 7 improvised explosive devices last month with chemicals he bought online in May and took the bombs to Manhattan, according to an indictment a grand jury handed up on Tuesday. Gann of Long Island stored some of the devices on the rooftops of adjoining residential buildings and threw another onto the subway tracks on the Williamsburg Bridge, prosecutors said. No one was injured by the devices. Gann was arrested in early June near the buildings, and authorities said he had one of the devices in his possession. Gann put countless lives at risk. Jay Clayton, the interim U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, said in a statement. Gann is charged with attempted destruction of property by means of explosives, transportation of explosive materials, and unlawful possession of destructive devices. He could face up to 40 years in prison if convicted on all accounts. A judge ordered Gann detained following a bail hearing. His lawyer, Martin Cohen, declined to comment on Wednesday. Our next story. New Paris mural honors Josephine Baker. Attribution to Nicholas Garriga. Paris is reviving the spirit of the U.S. French entertainer and civil rights activist Josephine Baker with a new mural. 50 years after her death, Baker now gazes out over a diverse neighborhood of northeast Paris. Thanks to urban artist FKDL and a street art festival aimed at promoting community spirit. Born in St. Louis, Missouri, Baker became a megastar in the 1930s, especially in France, where she moved in 1925 as she sought to flee racism and segregation in the United States. In addition to her stage fame, Baker spied on the Nazis for the French Resistance and marched alongside Martin Luther King Jr. in Washington. She died in Paris in 1975. I feel moved and I feel happy because this is part of a memory of my mother, her son, Brian Baker, told the Associated Press at the unveiling of the mural Saturday. He was one of 12 children Josephine Baker adopted from around the world that he called her Rainbow Tribe, and what her son called a little United Nations. Our next story. United Nations chief raises economic angle on climate change. Attribution to Seth Borenstein of the Associated Press. For almost a decade, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres used science to warn about ever more dangerous climate change in increasingly urgent tones. Now he's enlisting something seemingly more important to the world's powerful, money. In an exclusive interview with the Associated Press, Guterres hailed the power of the market forces in what he repeatedly called a battle to save the planet. He pointed to 2 new UN reports showing the plummeting cost of solar and wind power and the growing generation and capacity of those green energy sources. He warned those who cling to fossil fuels that they could go broke doing so. Science and the economy show the way, Guterres said. What we need is the political will to take the decisions that are necessary in regulatory frameworks, in financial aspects, in other policy dimensions. Governments need to take decisions not to be an obstacle to the natural trend to accelerate the renewable transition. That means by the end of the fall, governments need to come up with new plans to fight climate change that are compatible with the global goal of limiting warming and ones that apply to their entire economy and include all greenhouse gases, Guterres said. But don't expect one from the United States, President Donald Trump pulled out of the landmark Paris Climate Agreement, slashed efforts to boost renewable energy, and made fossil fuels a priority, including the dirtiest one in terms of climate and health, coal. Obviously, the Trump administration in itself is an obstacle, but there are others. The governments in the US don't control everything, Gutierrez said. While Trump pulled out of the Paris Accord, many states and cities are trying to live up to the Biden administration's climate-saving goals by reducing the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas that release heat-trapping gases, Gutierrez said. People do not want to lose money. People do not want to make investments in what will become stranded assets, Gutierrez said. And I believe that even in the United States, we will go on seeing a reduction of emissions. I have no doubt about it. He said any new investments in exploring for new fossil fuel deposits will be totally lost, and called them just a waste of money. I am perfectly convinced that we will never be able, in the history of mankind, to spend all of the oil and gas that was already discovered, Gutierrez said. But amid the hope of the renewable reports, Gutierrez said the world is still losing its battle on climate change, in danger of permanently passing 1.5 degrees Celsius warming since pre-industrial times. That threshold is what the Paris Agreement set up as hoped for global limits to warming 10 years ago. Many scientists already pronounce the 1.5 threshold dead. Indeed, 2024 passed that mark, though scientists say it requires a 20-year average, not a single year, to consider the threshold breached. A scientific study from researchers who often work with the UN last month said the world is spewing so much carbon dioxide that in early 2028, a couple of years earlier than once predicted, passing the 1.5 mark will become scientifically inevitable. Gutierrez hasn't given up on the 1.5 degree goal yet, though he said it looks bad. We see the acceleration of different aspects of climate change. Rising seas, glaciers melting, heat waves, storms of different kinds, he said. We need to go on fighting, he said. I think we are on the right side of history. Gutierrez, who spoke to AP after addressing the UN Security Council on the Israeli occupation of Gaza, said there's only one way to solve that seemingly intractable issue. An immediate ceasefire, a release of all remaining hostages, access for humanitarian relief, and paving the way for a serious political process leading to the two-state solution. This brings us to the end of today's broadcast of the Arizona Daily Star. Thank you for listening. This is Alan Jones signing off.